coworkers. Tonight we're going to talk about real-world examples of integrated branding, digital innovation, and media savvy, which are required in today's very competitive travel and tourism market. I'm going to let each of our panelists introduce themselves, but just so you all know who they are, this is Karen Foster Durham. She has a 30-plus year career in public relations, specializing in multiple, is it not 30?
No!
Oh, sorry. Well, you were 18. 20-plus year career.
Okay.
30. Public relations, advertising, marketing, and was owner at her own advertising agency, which is one of the most significant firms in the Mid-Atlantic. She has a significant travel and tourism portfolio and background. Kara Dentz will introduce herself next. Kara is executive director for the Greenbrier County Convention and Visitors Bureau. Came by her career in tourism by studying tourism specifically at her alma mater. And we'll talk to you about her career path and experiences as she introduces herself. And last but certainly not least, although she is an Orangeman from Syracuse and we like her in spite of that, is Lynn Swan. And Lynn Swan is Director of Communications at the Omni Homestead Resort in Hot Springs, Virginia. She and I work together at another five-star, five-diamond resort in southern West Virginia. And that's where we met, but she's going to talk to you about her experiences. So what we're trying to give you is the broad perspective of industry, advocacy, and advertising marketing firms, DMOs and convention and visitors bureaus who market destination organizations, and then destinations themselves who try to market significant events or remain worthy, engaged, content-driven as they try to get guests to visit and return visit. So Karen, I'm going to start with you to introduce yourself.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Karen Durham, as Alex said, and I have worked in the tourism industry not 30 years, because I'm not old, but whatever. But I did begin my love of tourism working at Cedar Point during college, and then had a lifelong love affair with tourism. I worked on state tourisms, local tourisms, because English I haven't had, but sort of number 20 of. But for state tourism boards, West Virginia, Virginia, and Nevada, many convention and visitors bureaus. I've worked with CARA for a number of years, Charleston, West Virginia, Richmond, Virginia, and then several attractions and destinations, as well as annual events such as the West Virginia State Fair and the Virginia Craft Brewers Fest. So I won't take up any more of your time talking about that, but the perspective that I bring is working from an agency's perspective on clients large and small with budgets large and small.
Kara?
Hi, I am Kara Dentz. I'm the executive director of the Greenbrier County Convention and Visitors Bureau. That's a big old name. I'm actually from here in Greenbrier County. I grew up and attended Concord College, which is now a university. That shows how old I am. But I received a degree, a BS in tourism management, and my specialty was in tourism planning, development, and promotion. I really fell in love with the industry when I started working summers during college at the State Fair of West Virginia. And I decided there were a lot of jobs out there where you're dealing with people that are, you know, not having fun or in pain, you know, whatever. I wanted to be involved in something where I knew what I did, people could have a great time. And so I actually moved to Tennessee after graduation. I worked for the Knoxville Symphony Society, Louise Mandrell, which I'm sure everyone in the room is too young to even know who that is, but she used to be pretty popular back in the day. She and her sister are a country music act, but she had a theater in Pigeon Forge, West Virginia. And then I worked for a hotel in Gatlinburg, but before I moved back here 11 years ago, I worked in three different positions with the Gatlinburg Department of Tourism in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. So you talk about a big destination, that was definitely one. And so I've taken all of those experiences in different realms of the industry to come back to West Virginia, and I've been here at the helm of the Greenbrier County CVB for about 11 years. And I think I bring a lot of experience about the things that can change. When I started here at the CVB, we had our marketing budget. We set out and bought all of our print ads for the year, and it was done. And boy, have things changed since then. So I'm very excited to be here. Thanks, Allie, for asking me, and I'll shut up now.
Thank you. And Lynn Swan, last but not least.
So, hello, everyone came and talked. I'm Lynn Swan, Director of Marketing and Communications for the Omni Homestead. We are a historic resort in Hot Springs, Virginia. And yes, I am a Syracuse graduate, as is my daughter, my oldest daughter anyway. But I got started after college. I went to work for Charleston Newspapers in advertising. And that's when I first met Karen, as I'm sure she remembers. And it's kind of funny, and this will date me, but one day after a bad day, I looked in the classifieds, which people don't do anymore, I know, for a job, and the Greenbrier had a little 3-line ad, and I applied. And the only reason they had an opening was because Allie was kind enough to leave the Greenbrier and go. But so I was hired there and spent 13 years there. Got to work a lot with Kara, which was wonderful. And then moved across the mountain, as we like to say, to Hot Springs. So I do bring a lot of perspective for what it's like for working for, whether it's an individual property or one that's part of a hotel chain, if you will. I've had experience with union negotiations, changes in ownership, bankruptcy, you name it, I've had all the fun. And as I did mention, my oldest daughter graduated this past May from Syracuse, and she is actually a journalist, so we get to have all those fun battles about journalists and PR professionals.
That's a good point of view.
All right,
so tonight we're going to talk about tourism, and you heard in their intros that each of our panelists, and myself included, have experiences that include both a marketing and advertising, so a paid side of the business, as well as social media, public relations, content, or earned side of the business. So we're going to talk about how critical integration is as we talk this evening. And any questions you have, I'm going to leave you time at the end of class to ask questions. But I think it's important, you know, Karen, and I'll let her tell the story, talks about you can't favor one part of the business of communications over another because they're all critical to what we do. So let's talk a little bit about tourism. Tourism accounts for $1.5 trillion, with a T, in economic impact in the United States, and those are 2016 numbers. It continues to grow. One out of every 18 Americans is employed either directly or indirectly in the travel or tourism related industry. So chances are you know someone who is associated or works in a tourism related field. In West Virginia and Virginia, tourism is big business for both. And today we have some experts to give you a nice regional perspective about that. So as we talk about this tremendous economic impact and how important the travel and tourism industry is, competition is key. So I'm going to start with Karen. Karen, talk to me a little bit about the metrics to determine the success of a marketing or public relations effort or campaign.
Sure. So the key thing for anyone to figure out, be it a destination and attraction, and Karen, Lynn, obviously, if you disagree, please say nothing, but if you agree with me, you can go ahead and nod and like the thumbs up. But the metrics need to be specific to the business goals. So if you are working to establish, if you're working to establish greater visitorship, and then all obviously that's going to depend both to the destination, to your attraction, to your website, and conversion is key there. However, you can't get lost in just the metrics because a lot of what happens in tourism is branding, and that happens organically, that happens through the paid side, that happens through what people read. And when we say read, please know I don't have delusions that people are picking up a newspaper and reading them every day, but news feeds and RSS feeds are full, and people are looking for content, and they're looking for information that's specific to what they like. And the relevance by which a destination is able to position themselves also help with the metrics. So if, for example, you want to be known as a four-season destination, it's important for you to be out there all four seasons and not in the season. You can't be talking about winter in January. You've already lost your traveler. So making sure that the metrics also move throughout the year to be consistent with what you need your travelers to be engaging with.
Kara, Lynn, other thoughts?
One thing I will add as it relates to an individual property, is that when we look at those metrics, we look at it in terms of the booking window as well. So for us, weather can be an important factor, i.e. this upcoming Florence is not being favorable to us right now. But we look at a booking window that might be 1 to 14 days, but also a longer booking window. So to Karen's point, in some cases, we'll be out promoting something 60 to 90 days out, but then also very short term to get those last minute business, last minute guests based on the weather.
So Kara, building on that comment, what are some challenges that you have with getting visitors to your destination and what you've done from a public relations strategy perspective to counter that?
I think some of the challenges, especially today, are being heard in all of the noise that's out there. You know, everyone is trying to reach the travelers. They're trying to get that dollar. Sometimes it's tough to decide who you really want to speak to. You know, we've looked at the past year, and we just keep thinking, oh, millennials, that's who we need to go towards. But when we do our research, we see that we're still just popular with the boomers, and that's okay. It's okay that, you know, we not necessarily have to reach out to someone who's just not interested in your destination. But it's about, you know, right now people are traveling for experiences. They just don't want to come and see something. They truly want that experience, whether it's a great food experience or, you know, doing something. So it's about us trying to cultivate those experiences, working with our partners, and then getting that content out. You know, it's really tough, especially for us as a small CVB. We have a budget about $1 million, and we have only 5 full-time staff. And so even though we work with our agency, trying to have the funds to cultivate the content, especially video content, which can be expensive, and, you know, just trying to make sure that everything that we're keeping on our website and in our social feeds is new and up-to-date and current, and trying to set us up above all the noise and get people to pick us over, say, Asheville, because they get all the love.
And Karen, I'm going to toss to you, and because we had this conversation as we prepared for the panel, that there's this tremendous conflict as you try to identify who your audiences are, because millennials dominate the world. Now, you Gen Xers or Gen Zs who are now in school, you're now driving the way people market and the way people communicate and the way people generate content. But what is it we say about the baby boomers? They've got the money.
That's right.
When they come to the destination, they're the people who can travel. They're the people who can spend the money. They're your parents. They're your grandparents. They're the people who can go and pick up on a Thursday and come back on a Tuesday because they can. And they have the financial resources. So why don't you talk a little bit about kind of effective messaging?
Yeah, definitely. And Kara talked about it a little bit. It not only has to do with being relevant to your destination, but relevant to many audiences. One of the things that I always talk about is how important one message translated across numerous audiences. And so one of the examples I always use is a family reunion. So if you think about a family reunion, you know, your mom sells a family reunion to you differently than she sells it to your dad, and how she talks about it differently to her sister, perhaps. But you're all still going to the same place. You're going to experience the same things. But once you get there, the experience is going to be very different. So making sure that if you are talking about, for example, one of Kara's signature events is the Chocolate Festival. And it absolutely positively has something to offer for everyone. But you can't talk about the Chocolate Festival the same to a 20-year-old, a 30-year-old, or a 40-year-old, and a 50-year-old. Because you have lots of different life happenings within there. So I think the challenge really is coming full circle and understanding all the different ways that you can talk about one piece of content to multiple audiences. So as you put on your PR practitioner hat, you really are a scientist and you're looking at the data to determine the most appropriate and efficient way to get that content in front of someone who will act on it to come to your destination to spend some money.
Well, Lynn, building on that from a question of competition and reaching different audiences, you have a unique perspective, obviously being a historic property. And I know if you could talk a little bit about what you did and the charge you led when the Omni Homestead celebrated their 150th anniversary and some of the public relations and content efforts that you had to kind of break through the noise and get people there and get people to kind of rediscover the homestead? Because, you know, there's this issue where you have newer properties offering the same amenities at a more economic price, easier to get to, et cetera. So talk us through a little bit of how you kind of reinvented or rebranded the homestead in that effort.
Absolutely. And Allie, it was actually 250 years.
Oh, see, fancy. 250.
So we are old, but we like to start.
I wasn't there when it started, just so far. I got on that.
No, so one of the things, like, I've been involved with historic properties and Historic Antiquities of America for years, and it's sort of the never-ending challenges. How do you keep up with these brand spanking new fancy builds that have all the really cool electronic bells and whistles and all the technology? And you can really get lost in that, but what you have to think about is what sets your property apart. One of the things that we did for our 250th was, actually, and I did this, fun times, came up with 366 fun facts. So basically one for every day of the year, because yes, it was a leap year. but what we did was we broke the year down and said, okay, for the month of January, we're gonna focus on our associates. For the month of February, we'll talk about the presidents that have been here. So on and so forth. So every month had a different theme, and then that helped me to go through our archives and Google searches and everything you could think of, calling people, looking at old books, finding little fun facts, like about when the movie Summersby was filmed in the area, which you guys probably never even heard of anyway, but it's Richard Gere and Jodie Foster. Or, you know, that this president liked to play golf here, or was given a hard time for playing golf, if you can believe that. But those fun facts really provided great content for the media, because you could find an angle, whether it was a golf pub or a culinary pub or a lifestyle pub or one that wanted to talk about family reunions. All of that content in little bite-sized nuggets had been curated the year before, and then we could use that the following year. One just a side note that I will add that I had to learn kind of the hard way: when you are planning a big anniversary celebration, the best advice anyone ever gave me was to keep it within your day-to-day operations. We had lists and spreadsheets of ideas from people. Crazy, like doing a flash mob in DC at the National Mall. And I'm like, okay, you organize that.
Yeah.
You know, we have a staff of two people here. But so keeping it into things that you can manage and that makes sense for your business operations.
Very good. Kara, anything to add? Lynn, Karen, anything to add? All right, well, I'm going to toss to Kara Dentz, and building on this idea of competition, talking about new trends and the impact of the sharing economy. I think as a direct marketing organization or a convention and visitors bureau, people coming to your area and not staying in hotels directly impacts the way CVBs are funded. How many of you know how a convention and visitors bureau is funded in your town? Besides you, Dr. Presgrove. A convention and visitors bureau is funded by hotel occupancy tax. So when you travel and you see that tax on there, it's a set percentage of the total room rate or total stay that then is given directly to the Convention and Visitors Bureau, or DMO, to market tourism in the area. So if you have people coming into the area and they're not staying at a hotel, what does that do to the tax base to support tourism marketing? Breaks it down. So Kara, why don't you talk a little bit about some challenges you've had in your market, because I know Bed and Breakfast, I know, presented somewhat of a challenge, and how you all try to overcome that market in more traditional stays.
Yeah, it's very interesting, and it's an issue that many states across the nation are trying to face, especially from the lodging perspective. If you're dealing with VRBO or with Airbnb, for example, we have a hotel. It's an older historic boutique hotel. It has about 21 rooms. It's the General Lewis Inn that's right here in downtown Lewisburg. You can actually walk to downtown. We have a younger couple, a local couple that just purchased it about 3 years ago. They're doing some amazing work, and they put a lot of money into it. But one of the issues that they're having is that someone that sits their home sits right beside of them is a VRBO property, an Airbnb. And so they are competing with this house, and this, you know, these people here at this house are not collecting the hotel motel tax. So it's an issue of a level playing field. And, you know, periodically I will get on VRBO or Airbnb and go on their website, and it's amazing the number. Even here in small town Willisburg, there are over 40 Airbnb properties. And so you think if it's not a popular time of year, if people are staying in those, that's the opportunity for 40 room nights that could be in our hotels that are paying that tax. And so the tax actually comes either to the county or the municipality first, and they split that money. Half of it comes to the CDB and half of it goes to that county or municipality. So both entities end up losing out on that tax base. And right now, statewide, there's not a way to really control that or to make sure that those folks are paying that tax. And so it's ended up being really kind of a ground up effort. You know, we go online and see if we can figure out if we know those folks, and then the city of Willisburg is sending them a note saying, hey, you need to be paying this tax. So it really is something that, you know, we're all trying to deal with. Especially, I think there are maybe two or three Uber drivers here in our area, and, you know, the taxi company doesn't want them going to the airport. So there are definitely some growing pains. And, you know, it's something that we talked about as we put together our visitor's guide. We are funded by the bed tax, and we are not a membership organization. So we market all tourism businesses in Greenbrier County. And because of that, now we're wondering if these Airbnbs or VRBOs, they start paying the tax, how are we going to list them in the visitor's guide? And how is that going to make, you know, someone at these hotel properties feel, because we're advertising them too? So it's definitely presenting a challenge, and things are happening a lot quicker than government, of course, can keep up with, and the laws that do these things. And even, you know, especially in a smaller town, in a smaller area, and even a smaller state, like West Virginia.
Very good. Allie, I think to add on to that, so I love having Kara's perspective because she's from the destination. But I think when you look at it from a consumer's perspective, you can sort of do a devil's advocate because the consumer wants an authentic experience. The consumer wants what they consider to be less hassle. And then the consumer is also spending 70% of their budget, 70% of their budget and 90% of their time outside of their hotel room. So the challenge that all tourism destinations have is a way to maximize on what people are doing when they reach the destination. And Kara's point is so poignant because the government is very unwilling to change the way they've always done things. But the disruption that's being caused is phenomenal because travel's now something that people talk about all the time. And people are considering things such as the Homestead or the General Lewis Inn attainable where they didn't consider that before. So when considering the sharing economy, it's super important to look at it from a 360 degree perspective. I'm all confused with Lynn and her date.
Sorry.
But it's really important to look at it from a 360 degree perspective because while it's offering great opportunity to the attractions, the destinations, and the restaurants, it's really hindering the ability of our DMOs to aggregate that and bring people there for a full experience.
Well, building on that, and I'm going to have you put on your Virginia Tourism hat for just a second and talk a little bit maybe even about Southeast Tourism Society and other entities and groups that support the industry. What is needed from an industry's perspective to guide them through that as they talk about it? Because I think to Kara's point, when you're marketing the VRBO on historic Lafayette Street next to the French Goat in your town, you are marketing the whole experience of Lewisburg, oddly similar to what you're marketing because you want people to come stay there, the idea of the destination. So Karen, maybe just walk us through from a from an industry perspective, the benefit and what the industry needs to do to kind of rise up and say, okay, this is how we need to work together.
Yeah, if only there was a simple solution or answer to that. because
I think Virginia
have,
has done some different things.
One of the things that Virginia has done quite well is public-private partnerships. And one of the best examples actually in Virginia can be the rest areas and the way, and so and during the McDonnell administration, funding was cut so drastically for tourism and tourism supporting services that we ended up shutting down 20% of our rest areas. The majority of people who travel through the state of Virginia travel on interstates. Yes, they arrive via planes, some of them use trains, but most of the people are going from destination to destination traveling. And the only way that we were able to get the rest areas back open was to go public with those. So GEICO stepped up in a huge way, and now you'll notice all up and down the East Coast that your rest areas are sponsored by GEICO. And when you think about that, you're like, oh, that's kind of weird, but think of the number of times you've stopped at a rest area because you just simply needed to get out, stretch your legs, walk the dog, get a Coke, get back on the road, have a place to eat. So the innovation is going to have to come, and we're going to have to be pretty comfortable being uncomfortable. I think the DMOs have the hardest time because they have to do so much with so little, and that pot of money keeps dwindling, but you don't necessarily, it doesn't necessarily correlate with the number of people coming to a destination. So your numbers may stay flat, but that's only the numbers you can report on because of the way you're able to charge and you're able to track people. So I think the innovation is going to come out of the sharing economy. It's just going to be a matter of what the consumer's willing to do. You're pretty used to if you go to a hotel room and they say, oh, it's going to be $99 to stay here. You get a bill for $125. You don't really scratch your head all that much. But when you go to VRBO and they try to charge you a linens fee, people like lose their minds because you've got to pay a linens fee. So I think it's going to be consumer driven. It's going to come out of the sharing economy, and the innovation is going to have to be from the government perspective, the consumer perspective, and then most importantly, it's going to have to come from somewhere. So if it's a bed tax, if it's a restaurant tax, if it's paying, Kara mentioned she's not a membership organization. Does she have to then go to being membership-based in order to fund what it is that she does to deliver an experience? So while that absolutely doesn't answer the question, I think hopefully what it does for those who are listening in the audience is show that in addition to what you have to do to get a person there, once they're there, we're still fighting over how to allocate their dollars and what to do with them once they get to the destination.
Very good. And I think building on that snacking culture, we can talk about the challenges of staying relevant. I know we touched on it earlier, but I'm going to toss to Lynn just to talk about some challenges with staying relevant. And I know you have a perspective both of having annual events that you promote and market for the destination of the Omni Homestead Resort, but also just generally staying relevant and being kind of top of mind awareness when people are doing a weekend getaway. Karen, I want you both to kind of answer this as well. Lynn?
Well, what I was going to say is actually Karen stole my idea, but in a different way.
She does that.
I know.
Yeah. Tell me everything you're going to talk about and I'll use it for myself.
In all seriousness, her idea of the family reunion and how your mom sells it to you differently than she sells it to your dad. So the example I was going to give, if you take that and you look at it, how do you pitch an idea to media outlets? You can't send the same idea worded in the same way to every single outlet. I mean, you could.
It wouldn't work.
They'll mock you on Twitter. this pitch, do they not know me? But one of the best examples that I had was, so for many years I worked coordinating this conference for food writers. And one of my all-time favorite panels was when one of the editors would stand up and read different examples of how to boil water. I know that seems crazy, but what she would do is she would read it in the voice of Bon Appetit, of Cook's Illustrated, and Sever, and Food and Wine. And it really made you realize how very different each of those publications are. So think for a minute about a beauty product that you love. Now think about trying to pitch that same product to Cosmo, to InStyle, to Real Simple. You can't give the same pitch. So you really have to know your audience. And that's kind of what it comes back to, what Karen was saying, is just know your audience, whether it's media outlets, whether it's a demographic target, know who you're talking to and speak in their language. I mean, I very rarely, like, even when it comes to social media outlets, you're going to word something differently on Instagram than you will on Twitter or Facebook.
And if you don't, please get off the social media. Was that out loud? I sometimes do that.
Very good.
Okay, sorry.
No filter needed.
Well, and I think,
Okay.
Now, what I was going to say, as a destination, something that I have really found is that we can't be all things to all people, and we shouldn't try to be. And I know that that's kind of hard to sit down and think that, why doesn't everybody like us? Why doesn't everybody want to come here? But that's okay. And the what you need to decide is who you are, who you appeal to, and focus on those things. For example, we don't pitch to children's magazines or people that are focused on kids because we're not a great destination for children. We do have some caves, and there are some things here to do, but we're really more of an adult playground. You know, we have the Greenbrier Resort. We have downtown Lewisburg where there's, you know, more upscale shopping, upscale eating. You know, the French Goat, which is our most popular restaurant right now, is just a wonderful experience. I would not for anything take my 12-year-old there to eat with me because she would ruin that experience for life. That's just, you know what I mean? So it's okay to not be everything to everyone and to figure out who you are, who you want to reach, or what you want to talk about, and what you know people love about your area, and focus on those things.
Very good. Karen?
I think the only thing that I would add there is that you have to, not only do you have to know who wants to come, you have to know who doesn't want to come. And then, like Lynn said, you have to know your destination inside and out, because you're going to have multiple audiences and you're going to have multiple opportunities to reach them. So making sure that you can, relevance is the key word there. Again, one of the things I love that the Omni did recently, the Homestead, excuse me, did recently, and it's not like it was yesterday, but they added a water park to their outdoor experience in order to compete with the popularity of bringing a family vacation and a family destination. So they've got this beautiful property, you know, and you could think that it's stuffy if you want. It's totally not. But to overcome that perception, they could then sell packages to families. You can hike, you can eat in the cafe, you can go to the water park. And it was a great way to reimagine a destination. Now, you wouldn't sell that the same way to a couple without children. But for a family, and specifically a multi-generational family, it was really, really smart. And that's one of the things I think that you have to know, is not only what you're good at, but what you're not good at, so you can be relevant to the people who want to keep coming back. Sort of fish where the fish are.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know several of you are in PR 215. I think you came with a class tonight. I don't know what, Dr. Presgrove, what acronym do they use now? It used to be RACE, then it was ROPE. What's the acronym?
RACE.
Is it RACE? So all of the foundation of your processes are going to be rooted at the beginning and end in research. And so just as a takeaway for what the panel all just talked about, and we're not yet finished, but that idea of knowing who you are, knowing who your audiences are, knowing what that information is, knowing what messages are effective, that's all found in research. it's all found in evaluation, research that you do throughout the process. I mean, using the last example, when they decided to do the Lazy River, they didn't do the Lazy River and water theme events at the homestead without saying, you know, we should probably have a secret utopia for moms and dads where no kids are allowed, which they do, right, Lynn?
Yes.
they have a glorious spa where there are no children, and you can't even hear them, even when you're outside walking in the outdoor pool. You can't even hear the children. They're far, far away. It's glorious. I recommend it. But I think that that's important for you to take away, that there's a fundamental, there are basic fundamentals to the process that we never abandon as public relations or integrated communications specialists. So that's something that I would offer. We've got a couple more minutes, a couple key points I wanted to get to, and then we're going to take questions from the audience. But I'm going to put these ladies on the spot, and Lynn, I have you on screen. Because I'm going to put you up first, and it was not a question that I created in our discussion guide, but just want to talk a little bit about how that knowing who you are, knowing what your strategies are, knowing who your audiences are, comes into play when you deal with a crisis. Kara Dawn, you're up next. Go ahead, Lynn.
Okay, well, I think this is actually going to go back a step. And that, okay, am I echoing?
No, you're fine.
Okay. You know, having those relationships with the media, obviously I do have some experience with crisis communications, as I mentioned earlier, about working through, I mean, it was a year and a half of union negotiations, and it wasn't fun, and it wasn't pretty. And then the bankruptcy filing and massive layoffs. So having those relationships with the media can make it a little easier, but you also have to, just as you know your audience, like when you're involved in a crisis situation, you're talking to potential guests, to your employee, to the families of your employees, to other businesses that rely on your business. So you kind of have to keep all of those things in mind. You may not be able to answer all of their questions all of the time, but being truthful and honest, and of course, staying in your box, you know, knowing your message and staying on point are really the keys to kind of getting through a crisis situation. Did that answer you?
It did, yeah. Kara, I'm gonna toss to you, and then Karen, you're next.
You know, our latest crisis, I hate to say it that way, but our last crisis was back in 2016 when we had a 1,000-year flood here in the area. It was something that was horrible. There were over 20 people that passed away. It was on the national news. There was a home that was on fire and going down the creek in White Sulphur Springs. It was very devastating. And so it was really tough for us to not only handle as professionals, but as people, knowing this was happening in our area. And it was really about knowing when to say something. You know, we didn't want to get on the air the next day and say, oh, we're fine, because we weren't. So it was about knowing what to say and when to say it, and knowing what not to say. So, you know, we really kind of went silent on our social media and those things until we felt that it was the right time to come back and say, you know what, we're going to be okay. The way we're going to survive this and the way that you can support our area is to come here and visit and to spend those dollars, spend that money. And, you know, on top of the PR, we put a special marketing piece together that went out to try to reach the people that we knew were our guests to let them know that that we were going to be okay. But it, you know, it was pretty significant. We had a PGA golf tournament that had to be canceled. So it's really about, you know, keeping in touch with that media, you know, working with your partners and working with people, you know, to support you. And as Lynn said, staying on message.
Very good. Karen, anything to add?
I think the only thing that I would add is that while your relationships with the media are really important, and telling the truth is paramount in any crisis situation. I would caution you to remember that they are not your friend, and they are there to report on a story. So both Kara and Lynn said, stay on message, stay in your box, know what to say, know what not to say, because it's critically important in a 24/7 news cycle that somebody breaks a story, that somebody has something that somebody else doesn't have. And if you are swayed by a relationship that you've had, or you're under the guise that the person is your friend, you would be mistaken. That doesn't mean that they're your mortal enemy. It just means understand the parameters for the job that you have to do as a public relations practitioner and stay true to those, because your ultimate responsibility is protecting whatever this crisis is about. So I would just caution in that regard.
Very good. If I can add one little thing, Allie, sorry.
Yes, ma'am.
That in crisis situations, and in even situations that are maybe not an immediate crisis, but like the union negotiations, lawyers can be your best friends. Listen to them. They will guide you. In all seriousness, you know, if you say, I'm sorry that the guest slipped and fell, and this is a poor example, but that could make your property liable.
Yeah.
And you don't want to go there, so you need to know exactly what you can and can't say and practice it.
That's a great point. There's no winging it in a crisis situation, and the people who do that are they're typically not rewarded.
You can think of 100 bad examples of people who don't handle a crisis well. Recent, old, etc. So building on this point, I think it's important as we talk about the practice of public relations, we also talk about how critical relationships are. Because, you know, to Lynn's point, this idea of you have to work with attorneys, you do. When you're dealing with labor negotiations, you have to work with human resources. When you are promoting information for a publicly traded company, you have to deal with accounting and other organizations within the company. More so than any other department in the company, you will touch everyone. You will have an impact on what they do because you are the message. You're essentially the face of the company, and you can't be the face or lead the company and lead the direction of the way people are communicating if you don't have a grasp on what's going on. So relationships are key. My most recent career stop, I worked for a bank, which Karen called my very annoying, ridiculous vacation in financial industry. I worked for a bank, and when I first went to work for a bank, coming out of the marketing and public relations and advertising business, everybody said, oh my God, Allie, you're gonna hate that. There's so many rules, it's ridiculous, it's so structured. But I found that I thrived in that environment because I knew what my box was. And as a crisis communicator by trade, I learned very well to say, okay, this is my dance space, this is where I'm allowed to be. But relationships were key. I could not be a successful communicator for a financial institution if I didn't have a relationship with compliance, if I didn't have a relationship with legal, if I didn't have a relationship with accounting, the executive branch, the employees, the retail branch. Because if somebody comes in and gets a rude teller, what's one of the first places they're gonna go talk about it?
Social media.
There we go. They're going to complain about, thank you guys for participating. But they're going to talk about it. They're going to give you a bad review. They're going to post on Facebook. So you have to be prepared to respond, and you have to know the parameters of what comments we delete, what comments we keep, how we respond. Do we need to take someone offline to get them to cool their jet? Have someone call them directly and say, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry, we messed up. Let us fix that for you. So relationships are key. So I want each of you to do this, and then we'll take questions from the audience. Karen, talk to me about relationships in your practice and in your tourism practice specifically, and why they matter.
I think the relationships you kind of said everything, so whatever. I'll just walk out some words. But I do think that relationships are critical. And in my experience through my career, relationships were built on mutual trust and respect. And if either the trust or the respect were in any way damaged, that relationship was no longer valuable to me, either personally or professionally. So I think depending on the route that you choose to go, making sure that you remember, and I'm actually going to go back to the introductions that we did. I worked with Lynn early in my career and early in her career. Allie and I started our careers together. I met Kara Dentz the first day she started at the Greenbrier County CDB.
And then we called to ask her a favor.
Yeah, yeah. That's my style. But I hope what that will demonstrate to you all is we've lived many lives since those times, and the relationships are still strong. Allie called and said, I'm going to tell bad things about you if you don't agree to do this panel. So I said, okay, I'll do it.
That's right.
And I showed up, even though I didn't like the way my hair looked, and I said, well,
Kara, you're next.
Relationships are really important. I work for a board of directors, so I have a board that I report to, and I only have 5 staff members. So all of those relationships are important in my line of work and what I do, and even the gal that takes care of our public relations. It's important to build those relationships with all of our partners. And I have to have relationships with all 5 of my funding entities. And those are all, they're all politicians. And, you have to not only build the relationships, but you have to know the angles, what everybody needs and what everybody is doing, because that way you can understand it and to be able to build that relationship and work with them. And it's also important to build relationships with other businesses, folks in other businesses like yours, across the state. I have a lot of great relationships with other CBBs, other marketing folks. Today I had an issue that I needed someone to talk to, and I picked up the phone and called an old friend in Mobile, Alabama, and he picked up the phone immediately, and we had a great conversation, and I hadn't talked to him in 6 months, but I knew that he wouldn't mind if I picked up the phone and called him, and it was, I can't even tell you how great it was to be able to talk to him and get that advice from him. So, keeping those relationships and building good relationships with great people is really important to you.
Swan, last but not least.
Can I tell my story?
All the good things about me. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, that would take too long. No, so I'm going to give you all a quick story about something that happened it started in April 2010. So some of you may remember the Upper Big Branch mining disaster that happened just outside of Beckley. Well, I had a local radio station call me and say, hey, can the Greenbrier send food? And I said, absolutely. So I got with our food and beverage team. They sent a truckload of food. They sent so much food to the families that the families had too much, so they shared with the media. And it just so happened that the gentleman who was there from CNN covering the disaster was John Roberts, and John got some of the food. Well, John wanted to then propose to his girlfriend, Kara Phillips, who was also with CNN. And so what did he do? He decides to book a room at the Greenbrier simply because they both love golf, but really because we had made that food donation and he then became more familiar with the property. So I'm kind of going to abbreviate this here, but I became involved because he was media. And so I helped with the engagement and really then just build a friendship with them just by trying to do some extra special little things to make the proposal something very memorable for both of them. So that was all wonderful. That was late April. Well, then fast forward a couple of months and it's the very first Greenbrier Classic. I reached out to John because some of the golfers were making donations based on how many birdies they hit, and Jim Justice was going to match it. John did a story. He interviewed Jim Justice and Sergio Garcia live on CNN on the first day of the tournament. Now that's a huge, huge win, but it wouldn't have happened if we hadn't sent food and then things evolved. But so what I'm trying to say is you never know where one random connection can lead you.
And you now have that contact at your current property.
Yes, and so he can visit me. A couple months ago, it was wonderful to catch up.
So relationships are critical. I could put together a panel when Dr. Presgrove told me to had I not been able to bully these women you see before you. They have been critical to my career in development and career path. And relationships that you make at WVU, relationships you make in internships, will carry you through. My first boss is still a mentor. The things I learned from her, and we could not be more different. I mean, you all know her. I swear she keeps me around because I swear. I say the F word, and she would rather die than say a swear. But that's why she keeps me around. Trash mouth. But it is a relationship that has guided us and supported us along the way. So relationships are critical. So whatever you do going out, it isn't just a one-time thing. Relationships matter, and building on those relationships are key. So I'm going to let you all ask questions. I will repeat them to the panelists because I don't know if they can hear you from the room, but we have time for a couple questions. Yes.
Okay. So what got you interested in this industry? Was it like a personal connection, like experience? Like what really like drove me to start doing this?
So the question is, what got you into this industry? I will answer first. I became involved with tourism when I accepted my job at Charles Ryan Associates on Karen's birthday all those years ago. And